Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, konnichiwa, aloha, people of the earth, how are you, everyone? I hope you are well. I am well, thanks for asking. And so welcome to Indie Author Answers, as the guy at the beginning of the song already told you, so I don't know why I'm repeating all that. Anyway, I'll repeat this part. I'm Jim, Jim of Heskett, and welcome to the show. I'm glad you're here. I hope you'll stick around. What's going on with me? Man, I've been crazy busy lately. I can't even get into it, but you're so lucky out there in podcast land that I still make time for this show, because I don't have to. I do what I want. No, I'm just kidding. I love you guys, and I'll always make this show in one form or another. More on that later. I've been thinking about what I'm going to do when we're out of sections of The Problematic Virtue to read, and I have a plan. I'm not ready to reveal it yet, but we'll talk about that, 15, 20 episodes from now when we're getting closer to it being over. Anyway, so let's keep things rolling. Today, I want to do a tip of the week about themes in fiction. And this is something that I know a lot of newer writers struggle with. And specifically, I want to talk about Stephen King's theory on choosing a theme for a book, as he described in his memoir/writing advice book on writing, which if you haven't read it, I recommend it. I mean, I don't agree with everything he says, but it's a pretty good book, and it's got some really solid advice. Anyway, so in On Writing, Stephen King talks about how he selects the themes for his book and he says during the first draft he doesn't even worry about theme. It's not something that enters his brain when he's writing out his first draft. Now, he's a pantser, so that may be a little bit different, but to me it's not. I'll explain why. Now, when I was writing The Problematic Virtue, and I first listened to the audiobook version of On Writing maybe not too long after I had written The Problematic Virtue. So when I heard that advice, that sounded crazy to me. That to me, at that time, theme was something that had to be carefully planned, integrated into the story arc, integrated into plot points, and integrated into characters. So that seemed like terrible advice to me, because I've discussed this before, but in The Problematic Virtue, the theme is related to loyalty and how different people see loyalty differently. And I knew that going in, so I structured a lot of the plot to make sure that loyalty was referenced often. And in On Writing, Stephen King says what he does is, like I said, he doesn't worry about it in the first draft, but then after he writes his first draft, he goes back and he reads over his text, and he starts to note places where certain thematic elements come up. Maybe that doesn't make sense. I can kind of explain it. I've talked several times about my Whistleblower trilogy and the first book in that series, Wounded Animals. Now, I mostly pantsed Wounded Animals. I used very loose beats that I didn't stick to when I was writing it. I'm sure I've mentioned this before. I'm somewhere in between pantser and plotter in that I use beats, but I allow myself the freedom to change things up and go where the story takes me. Then I just redo my beats if I'm halfway through and they don't resemble the book anymore. So when I wrote Wounded Animals, I wasn't thinking of theme at all. I was just spitting out the story as quickly as I could, discovering it, making up things as I went along, enjoying myself, having a good time, and I wasn't worried about theme. And then, lo and behold, after I wrote that first draft and I went back and I was reading through it, I started to notice things that I had unconsciously written into the text that resembled certain thematic elements. And what I noticed coming up over and over again was the theme of hope, because it's a book about a man whose wife is kidnapped, or maybe kidnapped. He doesn't even really know, but she's disappeared, and he's proceeding under the assumption that she's kidnapped, and he's searching for her. And over again, what happens is he thinks that there's try-fail cycles where he thinks that he's going to find her, and he meets with a dead end. And so he gets a lead, and he builds up hope, and then the lead turns out to be a dead end, and then his hope is crushed. So the theme of that book essentially is, how far can you push hope, or how long can you hold on to hope to keep you going? And that's what the main character, Kendall, is tested over and over again, his belief in his ability to find his wife and his hope. And I hadn't intentionally put that in when I was writing it, but as I discovered that as I was going through, I noticed, you know, the theme of the book is already there. And then, as Stephen King says in On Writing, after he discovers his theme by reading his first draft, when he goes back for his second draft, he purposefully inserts that. When he makes edits, he purposefully makes sure that the theme is reflected and brought up. And so that's what I did. As I went back, I focused on the hope. I focused on Kendall's internal struggle and his belief that he was going to find his wife and then keep hitting all these dead ends. Whether or not he finds his wife, I'm not going to say. You're just going to have to go out and buy the book. It's called Wounded Animals by Jim Heskett. And I think it's pretty good, but I wrote it, so you'd expect me to say that. Anyway, that's just one experience. I'm not saying that you have to do that in order to write themes successfully. I've read many writing advice blogs and been to writers' workshops where they talked about how important it is that theme be layered into your book. And, you know, if that works for you, I guess. But one other thing I suppose I should say, for a good lesson in theme, I would highly recommend reading Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane. It's a beautiful, wonderful book that's sort of in this quasi-no man's land between children's story and grown-up story. And Neil Gaiman does theme really well in that book because, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, theme is a heavy hammer. In The Problematic Virtue, I definitely use it as a heavy hammer. And by that I mean it's easy to do author intrusion and to hit people over the head with your theme. I'm sure I've talked about this before. But I did a review of The Ocean of the End of the Lane on my blog at jimheskett.com, and I compared it to the first Divergent book. And there was a line in there where the author had the main character, what was her name, Beatrice, reflect on the fact that they ate food pellets or whatever bullshit like that, you know, for nutrition. And she said something like, there used to be a time when food was made naturally, and it was so long ago, I can't remember. You know, like, that is really heavy-handed theming. And I find it annoying as a reader when I'm reading through this, like, oh, there's an overt message in here. Theme should be something that your readers discover as they're going along, and it shouldn't be overt. Anyway, that's all I have to say about it. So now, let's actually do some reading. Today we're going to read part 3, chapter 17, and it's a Miguel chapter. We're going to get back to our friend Miguel after not seeing him for a while. So here we go. 17, Miguel. Why are we doing this, Miguel? Parked a few buildings down from the Larimer Lounge in the Five Points neighborhood of Denver, Miguel kept an eye on the rearview mirror to make sure the target didn't slip past them and into the bar. You know why we're doing this. There's still one of them left. Ray, Thomas, and almost everyone else from Ray's crew that night were now gone. Now he had to finish what he started. Theo fidgeted in the passenger seat of Miguel's truck. Ray's dead. Why we gotta get rid of all them Northsiders? Without Ray, ain't nobody stepped up in that crew. I don't see what we gotta be so worried about. They all have to go, Miguel said. Theo stared at the roof of the truck as if deep in thought. Is this about the bridge? He said. Miguel wanted to believe that he excluded Theo to protect him. Miguel had only revealed what he thought Theo needed to know, but Theo wasn't an idiot. That's part of it, Miguel said. Or that party. didn't you tell me that you and him got into it at Thomas's? Yeah, Miguel said, couple days before the bridge. What happened? You ain't told me, Theo said. Me and Ray and a bunch of them were at Thomas's apartment, and Ray was drunk as hell. You know how he got when he was hammered. Well, he started getting ornery when we were playing Hour of Power and said some shit about Maria. Like what? He was dating her then. Anyway, he started talking like he was going to smack her around, and I just lost it. I cracked my beer bottle over his head. Thomas and Eduardo and them dragged my ass out of there before anything else happened. If anyone hurt Maria, you wouldn't have to do shit, Theo said. I'd pop a cap into myself. Miguel studied his companion while the intent of Theo's words took shape in Miguel's mind. Some guys Miguel might smack across the mouth for this, but not Theo. They'd make a good couple. Miguel continued. Next time I saw Ray, he pointed a damn gun at me. At the bridge, Theo said. Yeah. I don't get why you ain't ever tell me about it. I mean, the whole story. Miguel considered it. Perhaps keeping Theo in the dark for so long had been unkind. Are you drunk? He said. Theo cleared his throat. Yeah, a little. That explained Theo's curiosity. Miguel decided to tell Theo some of the details, but not everything. Okay, I'll tell you about it. I showed up there that night, and they were all pointing their pieces at my homeboy Brian, who was just lying there on the ground. He was scared shitless, but I knew they weren't going to shoot him. They might shoot me after that crap with the beer bottle, but I knew Brian was going to be okay. Ray and his Northside crew were always about looking big, getting respect, and all that, but Brian didn't know that. I just parked my truck and stepped on out. Did they start blasting or something? No. First, they just switched their guns to me. I moved back and got my shotgun, and they were all just standing there. They were waiting for me to do something. I was waiting too, but nobody was doing shit, so I told Brian to get in his car and leave. A couple of them bitched and moaned, but Ray was cool with it. I was kind of surprised. Ray didn't seem to care so much about some white boy anymore. At least that's how we acted. But I knew that me showing up made it worse for Brian. Now I had screwed up whatever plan they had for him, and there was going to be payback. How you get out of there? Before Miguel could answer the question, he noted a dark-skinned man with blonde hair walking into the bar. Wait up. I think he just went into the bar. Tell me how you get out of there. Not now, Theo. All right, then. Let's do this. Theo removed a pistol from the glove compartment and popped out the clip, then checked the safety before sliding the clip back into place. I can handle this guy. Just wait here. What the hell? Theo said. Why you always got me waiting in the car? Just stay here. Wait till you see me come out. Miguel exited the truck and followed the man. Once inside, he realized that he had identified the wrong person. Same look, but wrong guy. Instead, he ordered a Dos Equis and took a seat at the bar. He sent a text to Theo explaining and then waited. Miguel had learned that the man he sought, named Carl, sometimes known as Carlito or just Lito, frequented this bar and liked the shitty house band, the name of which Miguel had already forgotten. He'd only ever seen Carl that night at the bridge, but Miguel knew that he was Hispanic with bleached blonde hair and wore thick prescription glasses. A few minutes passed, then Carl emerged through the front door and Miguel retreated from the bar to a back table. Carl's appearance was as described, plus he had a sizable beer belly and waddled like a duck as he moved. Fortunately for Miguel, Carl came alone tonight. Unfortunately for Miguel, it turned out that Carl actually had come to see the band, and so Miguel had to spend several more hours watching Carl watch the band while he downed tequila shots. Miguel remained in the back of the bar, texting updates to Theo and nursing his beer with a line of sight to Carl. His target never detected him. Around midnight, the band finally finished their last set. Carl had one more shot of tequila, made a feeble attempt to flirt with a waitress, and after rejection, paid his tab at the bar. Miguel shadowed him as Carl waved goodbye to the waitress and the bartender, then exited the front door. Miguel kept his eyes forward and eased after him. Carl wobbled along the sidewalk in a zigzag pattern. He had drunk a few too many. Miguel kept a reasonable distance, and Theo entered his peripheral vision on the side of the street. He motioned to Theo to stay back. I got this, he mouthed to his companion. A long line of cars flanked Larimer Street, and Miguel realized that if Carl got into one of these parked cars, that would void the evening's effort. He did walk toward one, but drunkenly bounced off the passenger side and kept on walking. Miguel approached the vehicle and smacked the hood to silence the alarm that Carl had activated. They had walked far enough away from the bar that likely no one saw anything. A welcome turn came when Carl stumbled into an alley. Miguel leaned around the corner as Carl slumped against the side of a building, his eyes rolled back into his head. Miguel surveyed the alley. They were alone. He considered waiting for him to pass out, but then Carl stirred. "You," he said. "Yeah, me." Carl studied himself against the wall. "I know why you're here," he said. "You do?" "Yeah, I remember you and your gringo friend that night. It's all that shit about karma and all that. All I can say about that night was that you fucked up, man. I wasn't supposed to go down like that." Miguel inched toward him. "Wasn't supposed to go down like what?" "The white guy, Brian. Wiles told us to draw on him, and then you showed up with that big old shoddy. What were we supposed to do? It got, you know, complicated. What you did with that shotgun pissed me off, but I have to say it was clever. I had bits of glass in my face for 2 days." This presented a confusing wrinkle because it contradicted what Wiles had told Miguel during their post-Ridge confrontation. Wiles had said that Brian went to Commerce City to do a deal. "Wiles told you to draw your guns on him? Why would he do that?" Carl shrugged and Miguel looked deep into Carl's eyes, but only emptiness looked back at him. Miguel decided he wasn't going to get any answers from this drunkard, that every moment Miguel spent alone in the alley with him increased the risk of drawing attention. Miguel reached into his back pocket and produced a switchblade. He held it behind his back. The knife clicked as it opened, but Carl didn't seem to notice. Miguel closed the distance between them, and Carl did nothing. Carl's eyes were barely even open. Miguel lowered the blade to his thigh and leaned in close. He grabbed a chunk of the bleached hair and pulled Carl to the ground. Carl grabbed at Miguel's hands, but Miguel easily overpowered him. Miguel twisted Carl by the head to expose his neck. "Hey, what are you doing to me?" "It's not personal, Lito. I just can't let you live." Miguel felt pressure against his crotch. He looked down and Carl was holding a small pistol pointed directly at Miguel's manhood. Carl's finger wrapped around the trigger. "Why don't you drop that knife, Miguel? I don't know what you think you're doing out here, but you're not going to cut me tonight." Miguel did as Carl commanded. He had to think fast. He looked around the alley but could see nowhere to run or hide. He considered trying to swipe the pistol out of Carl's hand, but with a man's finger on the trigger, he may not be quick enough to disarm the guy. From above came a whistling sound. Miguel turned his gaze upwards just in time to glimpse a potted plant fall through the sky, which crashed onto Carl's head. Carl appeared dazed, and so Miguel snatched the knife from the ground. He dragged the blade across Carl's neck, silencing him forever. He squinted toward the origin of the plant. Theo waved to him on a fire escape 3 stories above, and Miguel waved back. Miguel swiped each side of the dirtied blade across Carl's pants and then regarded the lifeless form, waiting for relief to come. It did not. All right, fucking A, we got a lot to unpack, so let's just go back and get right into it. First of all, we start this chapter off with the sin that I've mentioned many times, and that's starting with dialogue, especially because... So I mentioned this before, since the chapters are named with the POV character, starting with dialogue wouldn't maybe so terrible, but you would kind of assume that the person speaking would be the POV character since you've just seen their name. But in the first sentence of this chapter, we have dialogue that says, "Why are we doing this, Miguel?" So you have no idea. Someone's talking to Miguel and we don't know who it is. And we don't even find out until 2 paragraphs later. So what they're doing is they're hanging out in front of this bar in the Five Points neighborhood, and there's a mention in the second paragraph about a target. So we know Miguel is after someone. And in the second half of that second paragraph, we basically get some summary of everything that Theo's been doing. He says, "You know why we're doing this? There's one of them left. Ray, Thomas, and almost everyone else is gone. Yeah, I know he had to finish what he started." Now, if we can look at this whole... Miguel's whole killing the Northsiders arc as a try-fail cycle, what should have been done is the way it works. So going back from the beginning of part one, when Miguel pisses off Ray by hitting him with the beer bottle for the threats against Miguel's sister, then Miguel shows up to the bridge and he makes things worse because... At least Miguel thinks so, that him showing up there at the bridge where Brian was doing the drug deal pissed off Ray and all those guys. Then Miguel goes on this quest to kill all of the Northsiders, and he kills all of them except for one. And the one person that's left isn't the boss of the organization. So if this were a video game, he would have already killed the end boss halfway through and then left some inconsequential guy for his last mission. So in terms of try-fail cycle, it's kind of oddly structured. Because so let's talk about try-fail cycle for a second. So what's Miguel's goal? His goal isn't actually to kill all the Northsiders. His goal is to alleviate his guilt, to alleviate the guilt he feels over putting Brian in the path of danger. And we see that at the end of this chapter. It's not actually referenced, you know, that this is his internal goal is to feel better, is to alleviate this guilt. His external goal is to kill all the Northsiders. We don't get a reference to the internal goal anywhere until the last sentence of this chapter, where it says he was waiting for relief to come and it didn't. So in terms of a try-fail cycle, this is a yes but. Yes, he killed the last remaining Northsider, but it didn't make him feel any better. Whereas when he went into Ray's house, that was a no and. His goal was to kill all the Northsiders. No, he didn't kill all of them because there was one left, and he didn't feel any better at that time. So let's go back to our line-by-line blah, blah, blah. Okay, so after we have the intro where we know where Miguel is and what he's doing there, we have basically two pages of exposition clunkily, which isn't a word, and I mean it is a word because I just invented it, clunkily written because we basically have exposition provided by Theo asking Miguel questions. And it is a way to provide exposition. You have two characters talking, and one character says, "What's the deal with this?" And the other character says, "Here, I'll tell you the deal with this," to impart information to a reader. And it's okay, I think, if you do it a little bit, and you know, it's probably fine in moderation. But here we have basically summarizing everything that Miguel's been doing and what he wants to do by Theo asking him questions about it. And it gets a little bit old after a while because Theo's like, "Why are we got to get rid of all of them? What do we have to get worried about?" And Miguel's like, "They got to go." And then Theo says, "Is it about the bridge?" And now there is a little bit of interesting stuff included here because we do learn some things in this chapter about what happened at the bridge that we didn't know before. So Miguel sums up what happened at Thomas's apartment when they were playing Hour of Power and Miguel hit Ray over the head with the beer bottle. And then there's this interesting segue when he talks about why he hit Ray over the head, about the threats toward his sister Maria. There's this weird kind of out of nowhere subplotty element where Theo says, "If anyone hurt Maria, you wouldn't have to do shit. I'd pop a cap on him myself." So Miguel knows that Theo has a crush on his sister, Maria. Now, this was the kind of thing that I think there may be a reference or two to this later in the book, but it doesn't really go anywhere. I mean, it doesn't affect the main plot. It's just kind of this quasi-romantic subplot that I included for really absolutely no reason at all and doesn't tie into anything or advance the story. And so we get back to the exposition, getting into what happened at the bridge. And there's even like, so, listen to this, how this is written. "Next time I saw Ray, he pointed a damn gun at me. At the bridge," Theo said. So Theo is serving exactly as the confused reader who needs to be reminded of what went down. So then Theo's prodding him to tell him the whole story. He's like, "I don't get why you didn't tell me about it. You know, I thought we were friends. Tell me." And there's this strange question where Miguel says, "Are you drunk?" And Theo's like, "Yeah, I'm drunk." And that explained Theo's curiosity. Well, we haven't really established before this that Theo is only curious when he's been drinking. So it doesn't really make sense why this is introduced as a character quirk of Theo now, that when he's drunk, he's curious. What that is just sloppy writing, me trying to justify this Q&A throughout the chapter by saying, "Oh, well, Theo's drunk, so he's asking a lot of questions." So all we knew about the bridge up to this point was that Brian showed up, they turned their guns on him, Miguel showed up, the Northsiders turned their guns to Ray, Brian left, and then something happened that shocked Miguel and made him so guilty that he's gone on this killing spree to make up for it. So now we get essentially the first half of what happened after Brian left. So we get the first half of Miguel's story alone at the bridge with the Northsiders, basically. So Brian leaves, and then Miguel gets his shotgun. And then that's basically all we know about what happened at the bridge. So I think there's actually three parts of the story. We're going to find out what Miguel did with the shotgun, and we'll talk about that again in just a minute. So Miguel goes inside the bar, and he makes Theo wait in the truck again. Now, there's a good reason this time why he makes Theo wait in the truck, because Theo has to come in at the end of the chapter and save Miguel. But this is the second time he's done this. The first time he did it just because I didn't want... So the first time he did it was when they were searching for Ray and they found Ray at his parents' house. Miguel made Theo wait in the truck because he didn't want Theo to learn anything Miguel didn't want him to know. That's what I wrote in the story, but I think I just didn't want to have to deal with the logistics of both Miguel and Theo being in the house and moving around. But now it's starting to seem like a pattern that Miguel always makes Theo wait in the truck, which is kind of strange because they're such good friends and Miguel trusts him so much, but he still makes him wait in the truck anyway for whatever reason I don't exactly know. I mean, the story reason is so Theo could come and save him later, but in Miguel's logic, there isn't really a good reason. It's not really explained very well by Miguel just says, just wait here, and that's all the reasoning he gives. So Miguel goes inside, and it's not the guy he's looking for, but instead of going back out to the truck and hanging out with Theo, he decides to stay in the bar for some unexplained reason. And then the guy he's looking for, Carl, or Carlito, or Lito, comes in a little while later. And then Miguel watches him for a bit. He's just nursing a beer while Carl is getting drunk. And so we don't know how long Miguel and Carl exactly are in there, but we know that it's after midnight when Carl finally leaves. But don't you feel bad for Theo? Just sitting out there in the car, like with nothing to do. So when Carl leaves, he's wobbling, he's drunk. Then we get, so here's the thing. At the end of the chapter, when Theo shows up, it really seems out of nowhere because he was just in the car, and then he's saving Miguel by dropping a potted plant on Carl's head. But here we have a little bit of an trying to explain why Theo knew what was going on, and I'll read it. Miguel kept a reasonable distance because he's following Carl, and Theo entered his peripheral vision on the other side of the street. He motioned for Theo to stay back. "I got this," he mouthed to his companion. So here we know that Theo is aware of what's going on. So it makes sense that Theo would have known that Miguel was in danger. I mean, we don't know how the fuck Theo got up to the balcony of some third floor apartment. That's not explained. But I know why I included this, because I wanted it to be more logical that Theo would have known, because here's something that you see all the time in TV shows and in movies that drives me crazy. When a character is in danger, in peril, and from out of nowhere, the protagonist or the protagonist's friend shows up to save the day. And I'm always like, where the hell did he come from? How did he know that that other guy was in danger? Like, it's supposed to be shocking and like the triumphant moment, but it always pisses me off whenever I see that. I'm like, where did you come from? How did you know that Bob was about to get stabbed? Anyway. But if we'd shown Theo, like, scaling the fire escape of that apartment building, it would have given it away. So it kind of makes sense why Theo is able to save Miguel later. And my intention, I think, was I wanted to mention Theo early enough and then not mention him again, because, like, that little thing where Miguel's like, stay back, Theo, is about halfway through the chapter, and then I wanted there to be enough word count in between that and when Theo saves him at the end that the reader would have forgotten about Theo. Because if the reader is thinking about Theo the whole time, then the reader's going to know Theo's going to save him in the end. So there's a lot of convenient stuff happening here. It's convenient that Carl is drunk. It's convenient that Carl stumbles into an alley. So everything seems to be working out for Miguel. Like, this isn't really very hard for Miguel. There's not very... If his goal in this chapter, his external goal, is to kill Carl, he isn't coming up against much resistance. I mean, the first thing that happened was he thought he found the guy and it wasn't Carl. And then the next thing was he couldn't kill Carl because Carl was hanging out in the bar, so he had to wait. So these are kind of little mini try-fail cycles. But then once Carl leaves, there's not really try-fail for a while because everything is working out in Miguel's way. So Carl stumbles into the alley, and then conveniently, so Carl reveals a piece of information that's kind of surprising, and it's good that at the beginning of this chapter we had the reminder of what happened at the bridge, because what Carl's about to reveal, if you've forgotten what happened at the bridge, wouldn't be surprising. But revealed, but now you're thinking about the bridge, and we reveal it, and it is a little bit surprising. I mean, it's not done really well, but I can tell you, like, if you're going to reveal something that happened that's related to something that happened 150 pages ago in your book, you can't expect it to be shocking if your readers have already forgotten what happened 150 pages ago. Anyway, so Carl's like, what happened at the bridge wasn't supposed to go down that night. So then we have a little bit of a mystery, because we knew before that Miguel, at the bridge, Miguel went, after Ray and them drew their guns on him, Miguel went to his truck and got his shotgun. And here we have Carl saying, what you did with that shotgun, but it was clever. I had bits of glass in my face for 2 days. So whatever Miguel did at the bridge, we know it had something to do with his shotgun and bits of glass. So we don't know that yet. So that sets up a little bit of a mystery for later, what Miguel did with his shotgun. But then Carl reveals that Ray and them drawing their guns on Brian wasn't a spontaneous thing. Wiles had told them to do it. That's the big reveal in this chapter. So we know that Wiles was involved in Ray and the Northsiders pointing their guns at Brian. And this is confusing to Miguel because it contradicts what Miguel or what Wiles said about it. After when they talked at the bridge, it was, you know, so Wiles and Miguel had a conversation that happened off camera after the bridge, and I couldn't have written about that conversation because it would have spoiled a lot of things that are going to be revealed later. But we know that it's so confusing keeping all these people in memory, right? And I'm the one who wrote this fucking book, and I can't even remember all this shit. So if you're following along, then my hat's off to you. You're really good at paying attention. So, but the point is, Wiles was involved. Wiles had orchestrated whatever happened at the bridge. Wiles orchestrated it, and Miguel didn't know that. So that's the plot point that gets advanced here. So Miguel is kind of like a detective. Like, while Brian is having this story about his budding love relationship with Megan and his difficult roommate stuff with Alex, Miguel is having this kind of detective story where he's piecing together things that happened at the bridge that night. And then we have our action sequence. Miguel draws the knife and he's going to kill Carl, but finally we get something that makes things difficult for Miguel, and that Carl has a gun and he points it at Miguel's crotch, which I can imagine would be a bad place to get shot. So then there's an action sequence where, you know, it's like tension, and this tension should have gone on a lot longer. Like, this should have happened as soon as Carl stumbled into the alley, because before that, there isn't really any conflict. Carl's drunk. Like, it looks like Miguel's going to have an easy time because the dude is just stumbling, but then he finally pulls the gun. And one thing that, like, from the time Carl pulls to the gun to when the plant falls on Carl's head, we have a whole lot of names used in these action sequences. And writing action sequences, I think, is really tricky, because if you have two people doing stuff, you can't use he and he. You know, if it's an action sequence with a man and a woman, it makes it a lot easier because you can say he did this, she did that. But if it's two men or two women, then you have to, you know, like, it's Miguel did this, then Carl did this, then Miguel did this. And it's really tricky, and I think I've gotten better at this by not writing so much quickly back and forth, by trying to keep it more in one character's point of view, because as we're switching back and forth between what each person is doing, it almost feels like we're switching POVs. Anyway, so the plant hits Carl, Theo saves the day, And don't you feel bad for Theo now? Miguel left him in the car for hours, and he still saved Miguel. So, like, talking about loyalty from before, the loyalty that Theo feels towards Miguel is definitely absolute. And that's essentially Theo's entire point as a character, is to be the embodiment of absolute loyalty. And as we talked before, Miguel kills Carl, and he's expecting it to make him finally feel better, to relieve his guilt because all the Northsiders are dead, but it doesn't make him feel any better. And so if there were a theme for this episode, it would definitely be about try-fail cycles, structuring them, and when they do and when they don't work. So that'll probably be the title, because I don't think of the titles before I do this. I just kind of come up with them as I go. Anyway, there's a little bit behind the scenes of Indie Author Answers. You're welcome for that. And if you guys listen next week, then I'll see you next week. All right, take care.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad, we will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.